Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Ukrainian Studies podcast, featuring discussions about Ukrainian culture and society with students, scholars, and artists around the world. I'm Rory Finnan, lecturing Ukrainian studies. In this podcast, Professor Timothy Snyder of Yale University offers a fascinating, provocative, and at times unsettling view into the contemporary tension between history and memory in Ukraine and Eastern Europe.
There is a great deal of resistance in the West and in the East to certain very easily demonstrable historical facts having to do with East European history or with the Holocaust, depending upon where one is talking about. The way that people talk about the famine in Ukraine, for example, in the West, has been very, very slow to change in the face of what I take to be the fairly overwhelming body of evidence coming out in Ukrainian and in the Russian language. Likewise, some of the basic things that have been documented and shown about the Holocaust in Eastern Europe are still resisted with great force and with great success in many quarters.
In June 2009, just before dawn, a group of five men took a hammer to a statue at the intersection of Kyiv's central thoroughfare, Khreshchatyk, and Boulevard Taras Shevchenko Boulevard. The statue was that of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, sculpted by Sergei Merkurov and erected after World War II. The group of men destroyed Lenin's nose and face and left arm. In the words of Mykola Kohanivsky, the self-described Ukrainian nationalist, who was the one to climb the ladder and deface the statue, the act was a gift, podarunok, to mark the birthday of Roman Tsukhevich, the military leader of the Ukrainian insurgent army, and a gift to mark the 100th anniversary of the year of the birth of Stepan Bandera, the leader of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. This assault on the Lenin statue in Kyiv is a striking example of the interplay between memorialization, commemoration, and violence, which is active to varying degrees throughout Ukraine and Eastern Europe. This interplay has been called by some a memory war. Recently, Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, in partnership with the Cambridge-based research project Memory at War, Cultural Dynamics in Poland, Russia, and Ukraine, invited Professor Timothy Snyder of Yale University to make sense of this memory war from a broad conceptual, geographical, and historical perspective. Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale and the author of such prize-winning publications as The Reconstruction of Nations, Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarus, 1569 to 1999, published by Yale in 2003, and The Red Prince, The Secret Lives of a Habsburg Archduke, published by Basic Books and Random House in 2008. His most recent book, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, has been named to over 10 2010 Book of the Year lists. Professor Snyder spoke at Cambridge on February 10th, 2011.
Thank you, Rory. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's actually rather odd to be here. If you spend a number of years at Oxford early in life and then come to Cambridge in the middle of life, it's a little bit like someone went back to chapter one and revised, and then everything changes afterwards. You know, there are familiar names and familiar lanes, but they're not the same buildings, and the lanes don't go to the same places. And then it's also true that some people to whom I was very close went to King's College in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and that's where I'm so happily staying. And so I've seen it through their eyes, and then I see it through my own later on. And then there's the fact that they were young then, although they're older than me now, or in some cases have passed away. And then my grandmother didn't neglect to remind me that we're descended from someone called Benjamin Blodgett, who went up to Cambridge from Suffolk in 1656 and left with 2 degrees in 1662 before moving off to the Virginia, what was then the Virginia colony. So, which is all by way of saying that, I hope in a way which is not too personal and extravagant, that history, what it is we do and how we record it, is always and already informed by memory. We can have memory of places before we even really set foot on them, which is certainly the case of me and Cambridge. And in some way, this is going to be the theme of my talk. Rory was kind enough to mention the book, Bloodlands, and I'd like to be clear that this talk is not really about that book. I'd be happy to talk about that book, its subjects and its arguments. But in a way, what I'm going to talk about is and this was the nature of the invitation, why that book wasn't written. In other words, if I had been hit by a tram, which I might have been, because I've lived in a lot of cities with trams. It's a reference to Master and Margarita, by the way. Something like that might not have been written at all, ever, which seems like a very strange proposition, I think, at least when you look at the sort of self-evident horror of the event. Because after all, We're looking at a time and a place, 1933 to 1945, the lands between the Baltic and the Black Seas, or west to east between, say, Poznan and Smolensk, where 14 million Europeans were deliberately murdered. There is no other event like that, at least in the history of the modern West. And yet, it had never been seen as such, and what I tried to do in the book is to make it make sense as an event, not just to make that observation, but to describe the intermediate events of which it is composed, beginning with the Soviet famine in the Ukraine in 1933 and ending with the Holocaust, all of which took place on the same territory, one after the other, in effect. But what I'll be doing today is instead to describe a kind of problem, the problem you could think about in terms of why writing a history like this is hard, why writing a history like this is not like writing a history of a cross-dressing Habsburg Archduke, which Rory was kind enough to mention. What I would like to do instead is reflect on the basis of the 20 years that I was thinking about this book, and on the basis of the 20 years that have passed since the revolutions of 1989, upon the divergences between what we know or perhaps ought to know about history and the way that this particular history is remembered. Taking for granted that the memory is in many ways driving the history and trying to think about how that is, and maybe a bit at the very end, how that might possibly be changed for the better. So let me begin by what I take to be something which is uncontroversial between those who focus on history and those who are in one way or another concerned with memory. I think pretty much all of us agree that the period between 1933 and 1945 is of interest. I think we all agree that the two regimes, Stalinist and the National Socialist regime, were of central importance. I think pretty much everyone, whether they're engaged in history or memory, whether they work on this directly or not, accepts that deliberate killing by those two regimes is somewhere near the focus of where our attention ought to be. Given that history specialists and pretty much everyone else agrees that these things are of common interest, the question would be, why are the ways in which this is remembered so different one from another? But also, why are they so hard to justify in terms of historical scholarship? Or to put the problem a bit more sharply, 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, to refer to that cliche, there really isn't European history yet. And more strikingly, it's not clear that there's even been that much progress made towards European history, with the exception of some books which are in fact exceptional, like Tony Judt's Postwar, for example. It's also the case that there isn't really European memory. Whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing is another question. But having paid some attention to all of this, and having lived in about a dozen European countries in the intervening two decades that I'm talking about, it doesn't strike me that there's even motion particularly in that direction. There are far more cosmopolitan East Europeans than there used to be, just by virtue of the ability to travel and a new generation emerging and so on. But I don't think that European memory exists. Insofar as it exists, interestingly, it tends to exist in institutions like the one that was kind enough to invite me here, which is a kind of European attempt to note, right, and describe categorize the various different European memories that in fact exist. So Europe exists insofar as it is attempting to catalog its own variety, which I would submit as a sort of tenuous form of European memory, if it's a form of memory at all. And I think the problem is in some sense deeper than that. There is a great deal of resistance in the West and in the East to certain very easily demonstrable historical facts having to do with East European history or with the Holocaust, depending upon where one is talking about. The way that people talk about the famine in Ukraine, for example, in the West, has been very, very slow to change in the face of what I take to be the fairly overwhelming body of evidence coming out in Ukrainian and in the Russian language. Likewise, some of the basic things that have been documented and shown about the Holocaust in Eastern Europe are still resisted with great force and with great success in many quarters. And I take this to be an instance of this general problem as well. We see these problems not all of the time. For the most part, we navigate among ourselves, we avoid difficult conversations, but they do come up. They come up particularly just following the calendar on anniversaries, on days like May the 8th, or if you prefer, May the 9th. They come out on round numbers where we have to decide what we think of the Warsaw Uprising or the liberation of Auschwitz by the Red Army. And we continue to have disagreements about this, but we have disagreements in a way which I'm not sure is ultimately going to be productive. And I'd like to now try to analyze why this might be. The first set of causes, I think, is the one which is most familiar, and that is the opposition between certain dominant and actually rather militaristic narratives of the 1930s and 1940s having to do with liberation. There is a very strong story coming from the Soviet Union, still very prominent in Russia, in a certain version in Belarus, and also in Ukraine, for that matter, which you could think of as liberation from the East. This is the version that's celebrated each May. Basically, the way this story goes is that events such as the famine in Ukraine or the Great Terror of 1937 to 1938 might have in some respects been regrettable, but nevertheless they were part of creating a Soviet state which then went on to defeat the Wehrmacht, and for that reason they are in some sense part of the story of progress, or at the very least of victory. Now, the problems with this are, I think, pretty evident. It's not at all clear that the famine and the terror helped. In fact, you can make a strong case that both of them hurt in this effort. You can also make a very strong case that Stalin misunderstood the nature of the threat to the Soviet Union, which was indeed real, but it wasn't the kind of threat that he expected. What he was expecting was a combination of a Polish-Japanese attack, which used national minorities and alienated kulaks. There was indeed an invasion, but it was a German invasion, largely without any kind of reference to opposition within the Soviet Union. So there is that narrative, and it's very powerful, and it has these problems, and it has others. Like, for example, if the war from the East was a liberation, why was the Gulag larger after the war than at any other time in Soviet history? Or if it was a liberation vis-a-vis Auschwitz, to which I'll return, why then were Stalin's last years so full of anti-Semitism? Then we have the historically even more egregious, although emotionally perhaps more appealing, American version, which is liberation from the West, which is basically the idea that the Americans came riding to the rescue just in time, as usual, defeated the greatest killer in history, stopped the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. That's the direction we're definitely moving. This overlooks some things that are so obvious that I don't feel like I have to belabor them. Like, for example, that when we, that's my American we, when we entered the Second World War, we were allying ourselves with Stalin, who at that moment, in December of 1941, was still the greatest killer in the history of the West, and that our alliance with Stalin did not prevent Hitler from surpassing Stalin and becoming the greatest killer in the history of the West. Both of those things are rather awkward. We don't like to think that we landed at Normandy at a time when the Holocaust was essentially over. We don't like to remember that we had no Jewish motive for entering the war, and if anything, it was the other way around. We don't like that we took no action to save Jews, and we don't like that we never reached any of the territories where the Holocaust actually happened, which is a bit where the American blindness intersects with a British one, which admittedly is, I think, much more partial and in general smaller. But the idea that the Holocaust happened at Bergen-Belsen, for example, is a common British misconception over down the generations. Horrible things happened there, but British soldiers, like American soldiers, never actually reached the places where the Holocaust happened, which is one of the reasons why our view of the horrors of the Second War and of the 30s and 40s in general is so limited. Now, the thing about these two narratives, as often happens with powerful narratives, is that they function together. They're not consistent, but they function together by leaving out certain things. They leave out the Holocaust, both of them, in ways that I've mentioned, but they also have a way of leaving out Eastern Europe, which was not liberated, so to speak, doubly not liberated. The Americans and the British never reached it, and what the Soviets did was in some way a liberation, but it was also the beginning of a new satellite regime dominated from Moscow. So, okay, we're familiar with those two narratives clashing from East and West. Perhaps, though, given that their problems are the Holocaust and Eastern Europe, historians of the Holocaust in Eastern Europe have sorted these problems out in the meantime. Okay, you know where I'm going to go with this. I'm going to suggest that that is sadly not the case, or it's much less the case than we might have expected. Let me start with the history of the Holocaust. This is a difficult place to start because since the Historikerstreit of the late 1980s, I would say that the historiography of the Holocaust has been the most sophisticated and probably the most interesting of any body of literature having to do with modern history, mostly in German, to some extent in English and other languages. It is worlds better than it was 20 years ago, and it is worlds better than most other historical discussions. That said, there are certain, I think, systemic problems with the way that the Holocaust is generally narrated in the historiography, which create problems of memory in a kind of indirect way. Let me try to be clear about what I mean about this. I think that the historical literature on the Holocaust is caught in a way that other historiographies are no longer caught in what you might think of as the post-colonial epistemic. That is to say, we look at the territories under colonial rule, in this case German colonial rule, from the point of view of the colonizers, while being quite critical of the colonizers, of course, but nevertheless looking at it from their point of view. Now, once I say this, I hope it's obvious what I mean. Almost all of the Holocaust literature is written on the basis of German sources, and for that matter, German sources alone. And that can take you very, very far. But there are certain places that it cannot take you. And in most other comparable bodies of study, people have already made that leap. So if you think, for example, of the history of South Asia, where Professor Bailey here has founded an entire school, one went very far using just English language sources, but now it's generally thought that you wouldn't want to study early modern South Asia, just for example, without vernacular sources. Interestingly, if you think of the occupation of France, let's stay in the 1940s and shift the gaze from east to west. Imagine someone writing a history of occupied France and then saying, by the way, I don't know French, and therefore I didn't use French sources. I think that would strike us as outlandish. At least that's a professional historian talking. I realize it happens. But I think in general that would strike historians as outlandish and something that you simply couldn't do. You know, where would the French people be? Where would Vichy be? Where would the resistance be without French sources? And yet routinely, and indeed normatively, when we write about Eastern Europe, that's we historians, we write about it without using vernacular sources at all. And I would like to stress that I think this is a fairly strange move. It means that if you use German only, you have a massive overrepresentation of minority victims, because only about 3% of the victims of the Holocaust, just to take the Holocaust, knew German. Only about 2% of the victims of German mass killing policies in general knew German. And if you bring together Soviet and German policies, that 14 million number that I spoke of at the beginning, only about 1% of those people who died spoke German. So what German is giving you is a very, very small view, and I would say an atypical view, because the German Jews who die in the Holocaust live much longer. About half of them survive, which is completely atypical. And most of them don't experience Soviet power, which is also atypical. So it's a very, very specific group. It just happens to be the one which is most familiar, I think linguistically, but also culturally. A similar problem comes in, although to a lesser extent, with the emphasis on Auschwitz. Auschwitz is, of course, a critical part of the Final Solution. It is the place where European Jews were brought in 1943 and 1944 as the Holocaust was being completed. Hungarian Jews were actually the largest group. But it is atypical of the way the Holocaust happened in a couple of ways. The first is that the two major victim groups of the Holocaust were Polish and Soviet Jews. And these groups were not very present in Auschwitz. Polish Jews were about 7% of the Polish Jews who died in Auschwitz, and virtually none of the Soviet Jews who died at Auschwitz. Auschwitz is familiar, rather, to us in the West anyway, because it is where people from Western Europe were sent, those atypical smaller groups of victims. It's also, I think, a bit more familiar because, and this is the very puzzling part, it was not just a death facility, it was a concentration camp. And the concentration camp is a much more comprehensible reality, I think, than the death facility, or for that matter, the pit over which people are shot. And so we have this idea that Jews died in concentration camps, which is basically false. The huge majority of Jews who were killed in the Holocaust never saw a concentration camp, didn't go through the process of concentration and so on, which aren't described. The concentration camp is more familiar to the Western imagination, but it's basically irrelevant to the event that we think we know, which is the Holocaust. I think the second problem, and it's related with the way that the Holocaust is explained generally or narrated generally, is that most books, most important influential books about the Holocaust, have two parts, in which the first part is about the 1930s. It's about rising anti-Semitism and the oppression of Jews inside Germany, their humiliation, exploitation, and very often immigration. And then there's a second part which describes 1939 to the end of the war, in which suddenly oppression of Jews suddenly becomes the mass murder of Jews. And the causal part of the story is generally sort of, so to speak, built up the 1930s. And very little is done to explain why it is that the war or contact with the Soviet Union or with Poland might have had something to do with this. And this, by the way, is characteristic of the two big schools of Holocaust historiography, which I won't go into. It's a problem of both functionalism and intentionalism. It doesn't take into account the fact that by the time the Holocaust had started, the lands where it was going to take place were already the greatest killing zone in the history of the modern West. Even if the Holocaust hadn't happened, which is, of course, a very difficult thought, the number of people killed in this zone would have been higher than in any comparable zone at any point in the history of the West, especially if you take into account the Soviet prisoners of war, which is the second major German war crime, the starvation of 2.6 million and the execution of another 500,000 Soviet prisoners of war. There is a very interesting book, Peter Longerich's Vernichtungspolitik, which has recently been translated under the less evocative title Holocaust, which brings about the best synthesis of these positions, the functionalist and the intentionalist. And one of the things that Longerich suggests, although he doesn't actually spell it out himself, is that once you bring together these two positions, and you've gone as far as you can with explanatory factors within Germany, you probably have to start addressing Poland and the Soviet Union, which he doesn't do himself. He's not able to. But he suggests that that's where one ought to go, and I think he's probably right. And I'd be happy to go into why that might be later on if you're interested. There is an exit, it seems, in the Holocaust literature from all these problems, and that's the problem. That's the exit is called everyday history. And this is the way that a lot of Holocaust history has gone since the 1980s. Part of the Historikerstreit, this dispute in Germany about comparability between the Soviets and the Germans that took place in the late 1980s, part of it was the idea of everyday history, Alltagsgeschichte. Was it legitimate to write about Germans staying at home, knitting, washing dishes, and so on? Was social history of that kind legitimate while the war was going on, while the Holocaust was happening, and so forth? And some historians of Jewish life or historians of the Holocaust have made a very interesting move, which is that they started writing Jewish everyday history, what was happening to Jews on a day-to-day basis. And I think the most successful example of this in a big popular book was Shaul Friedlander's Politics of the Years of Extermination. Now, the problem with all of this, okay, let me tell you why that's important. It's important because that kind of victim history breaks the Berlin-centered decision-making narrative of the Holocaust, right? It allows you to see what was going on underneath, and it means that you're not just thinking about Goebbels or Himmler or Hitler, God forbid. However, there is a certain problem, and it's a problem that I mentioned before, which is that the experience of German Jews is atypical. And in fact, we have precisely sources like Viktor Klemperer's amazing diaries because the experience was so atypical. That a Jewish husband could survive for so long would be unthinkable in other places further to the east. So you're getting an experience of Jews who often, and sad, it's so sad to put this, it's hard to find the right words for it, but the experience of Jews that is atypical because they live so much longer than Jews elsewhere. Elsewhere, the experience of Jewish life under German rule is not an experience at all. It's very often just the killing, which means that if you want to understand those Jews, you can't just look at Germany. You have to look at the territories where they lived. And of course, the huge majority of Jews in Eastern Europe, live precisely in Eastern Europe. Now, why is all this a problem for memory? Why have I spent so much time talking critically about the history of the Holocaust, which, to repeat, I think is probably the most sophisticated and interesting body of literature that we have about these sorts of events? I think that as a result of these two problems, as a result of this two-step explanation where you're very detailed about Germany and then you use that explanation spread out, so to speak, over Eastern Europe, and as a result of the problem of what I call the post-colonial epistemic, that you're seeing things from the point of view of the Germans, even if you're very critical of them, as of course people are, that this means that the places where the Holocaust actually happened, places like Mali Trostinets in Belarus, are unfamiliar. The whole terrain, the whole landscape, and the peoples who live there are basically unfamiliar. And they don't become familiar as a result of reading books about the Holocaust. What happens in a typical book about the Holocaust is that these terrains and the people who live in them rise up above the horizon just in time to be killed, basically. They appear on the page where they're going to be killed, again and again and again. The names of the places and the names of the people, if they appear at all, appear just before they're killed. And that means that these places and these peoples, as I see them anyway, are denuded of a certain kind of reality, which, let's say, German institutions enjoy in these kinds of accounts. Now, again, I'm not saying that colleagues don't know that the Holocaust happened in the East. Of course, colleagues know that the Holocaust happened in the East. What I'm saying is that this structure of narrative means that the lands of the East and their peoples often don't attain the same kind of plausibility, coherence, palpability, concreteness that victims in the West do. And what I mean, and of course, there are major exceptions to this, like Yitzhak Arad's wonderful and I think fundamental book about the Holocaust of the Soviet Jews, which came out last year. But I think the net effect of all of this is that the basic public misunderstanding from which I began about Western Jews' concentration camps is not undone by the scholarly literature in a way that we might expect. In fact, I think in some narrative sense, it's actually reinforced. So that's one side of the problem. Let me shift from one side of the problem, the history of the Holocaust, to another, which is national history, or the idea of totalitarianism as a national tragedy. Let me begin from this in what might seem like a strange way. My personal test of histories of the Holocaust is that I look to see to what extent they treat the fate of Soviet prisoners of war. The Germans killed deliberately about 3.1 million Soviet prisoners of war. This happened on the same place that the Holocaust happened, and the reasons why it started and stopped have a great deal to do with the reason why the Holocaust started, in fact, and I'm happy to go into that if you're interested. But in any event, it is the second major German war crime after the Holocaust. And it happened where the Holocaust happened, and as I say, more or less at the same time. It seems to me that one ought to at least ask if there's some relationship between those two things. And generally, that question is not posed. The politesse now is to at least mention the Soviet prisoners of war, but very often that's all it is. They're simply mentioned. That, for me, is a warning sign about literature about the Holocaust. But it's also, for me, a warning sign about national history. So let me pose this in the form of a rhetorical question, and you're going to know the answer because I've already belabored it. What is the largest victim group in occupied Poland as late as December 1941? It is not the Poles, and it is not the Jews. It is Soviet prisoners of war who were moved west and placed in what were essentially death camps in occupied Poland and then allowed to starve or die of disease in the fall and winter of 1941. That's the largest victim group in Poland until you get into 1942 in Operation Reinhardt, when the number of Jews killed exceeds it. It's a very, very high number. And nevertheless, you can write the history of Poland during the war without ever saying that. In fact, to my knowledge, every historian of Poland who has ever written about the history of the war has omitted that fact, which would seem to me to be a very interesting fact, right? So this forecasts something I'm going to be arguing at the end. It's interesting where the historiography of the Holocaust and national history overlaps in its problems. Now, what are the general problems of national history? The most obvious problem, and one I think I don't have to spend much time on, is the problem of geography. If you write history just in terms of the territory of a nation state, you can't actually grasp most of the worst things that happen. So even if you're writing in Poland, you can't really grasp the totality of the Holocaust, and you have an excuse not to. If you're writing about the Soviet prisoners of war, that crosses many different territories that are now different national states, and so on and so forth. You can't even describe them, let alone explain them. So if you stop within a nation state framework, you have that easy out. But I think there's something deeper which is going on here, which is worth assessing, especially from a European point of view. And by the way, when I criticize Europeans, just let me say from the beginning, I think Americans are worse. So anything I say, just double it. I mean, our national history is really quite extraordinary. And I'm happy to return to that, and I'm happy to talk about our views about our exterminations and so on. So please don't get the wrong idea. In any event, I think there's something interesting and deeper going on here about European norms, which is this. I think that the European norm, as embodied in national educational curricula, up through and including university, is still national history. And I think even when people try to correct it at the level sometimes of baccalaureate, sometimes later on, it's already been embedded in elementary school and in high school, gymnasium, whatever, lycée, before at a time when people are basically irresistible, which is the traditional way national pedagogy works. It gets into your mind at a time when you have no ability to defend yourself, when you're about 7 years old. And then later, when you try to be critical, you find yourself being critical within that framework which was already established while you were still eating soft foods. So that I think, is still where we are in European terms. And there's an exception, but that exception turned out not to be lasting. That exception was, interestingly, Eastern Europe between 1989 and 2004. What was interesting about that period? That was the period when East European states were candidates for membership in the European Union. They were trying to join the European Union. And it's amazing how much cosmopolitanism and tolerance trying to join the European Union fostered, right? Think of the concrete example of the reception of Jan Gross's book, Neighbors. Jan Gross's book, Neighbors, was published in 2000 or 2001 in Polish and in English. And in Poland at that time, it produced the single most interesting, I think, conversation about the Holocaust that has ever happened, including the Historiker Streit, including anything in Germany, more wide-ranging, more different kinds of voices, very often incredibly sophisticated. And it produced a response from the state in the form of a series of volumes, you know, which Gross himself then said, these now, in effect, supersede my work. This is the most important treatment of the events I describe, which, of course, is the murder of Jews in Jedwabne in the summer of 1941. Spring forward to 2004 and then consider the reception of Gross's next book and the one that's just about to come out. It's a completely different story. And there are contingent explanations from that, different people in government and so on. But I think the underlying explanation is this: a certain political correctness attended the attempt to join the European Union. And once people are in the European Union, they spring back to what I take to be the European norm of national history. But in Eastern Europe, there is still something special and something which makes all these trends a bit sharper, and that is the existence of what you might think of as memory ministries, if you're in an Orwellian frame of mind. These things don't generally exist west of Germany, but they generally do exist east of Germany. By memory ministries, I mean institutes of national memory, things of that kind, which unite judicial functions, pedagogical functions, historical functions, archival functions, generally multiple of those things, if not all of them, under one roof. The problem with these memory ministries, aside from the fact that they tend to suck up resources which might have been spread more evenly around universities, for example, the Polish one has a higher budget than all of the other history teaching in the country taken together, I think, which is something to think about. Aside from that problem, the way that they process history has certain issues. For one thing, they tend to focus almost entirely on post-war communism. It turns out that the war, although of course the nation suffered in the war, is a bit too awkward to be considered. And usually these things are repositories of communist interior ministry and secret police files. And the studies that they sponsor or tend to foster have to do with post-war communism. This means that events like the Holocaust are excluded, right? Unless there's some special reason to get into them. And it also means that you have this very strange tendency, a kind of worst of both worlds, which is that the tendency of people who work in these institutions is often to blame the outsider. Many of these institutions have taken a very conservative turn, including the Polish one recently, but the Ukrainian one very much so, the Czech one to a certain extent, the Hungarian one very much so. And that means that you tend to blame the outsider for what goes wrong in your country. However, you don't have the outsider's files. You have the files of your own, so to speak, communist interior ministry and state secret police. So what you do then is you use those files to find the outsider, and then the outsider turns out to be the insider. And so then, to a slightly artificial, I think, extent, you have these extremely polemical conversations inside the nation where people are being blamed and censured, and where, in effect, communism is being blamed, I think sometimes too much, on the people who are inside the country. And the great controversies turn out, I'll again take the case of Poland. In Poland, we now know that in 1937 and 1938, in the Soviet Union, more than 100,000 people were shot for being Polish spies. That has not entered Polish national memory because it is not part of this discussion. Much, much smaller events, like which priests betrayed which other priests during Solidarity, have become part of the Polish national memory, precisely because they're part of this conversation, an interior conversation about post-war communism, in which Poles are essentially blaming other Poles. So there's a kind of artificial constraint in all of this. Another problem that these ministries tend to, as a result of this chronology that they tend to enforce, is defining nationality in terms of ethnicity. And that's partly because the pre-war and wartime versions of these countries were much more nationally diverse than the post-war versions of these countries, right? As a result of the Holocaust, but also as a result of ethnic cleansing. And so When you do have debates, they are very often framed in these strange ethnic terms. Like, for example, to return to the example of Jedwabne, which I take to be a very important moment, in Poland in 2000 and 2001, this book by Jan Gross, in which he revealed that Poles had killed Jews in the town of Jedwabne, a very intelligent younger Polish historian made the point, we should be thinking of these people as traitors, because in killing Jews, they were, among other things, collaborating with the German authorities, and we should regard that as treason, right? We should think of them as Polish citizens and think of this as treason. No one followed up on that. The discussion was entirely about Poles and Jews, Poles and Jews, Poles and Jews. The paradigm that everyone involved was a Polish citizen and that somebody was betraying, one Polish citizen was betraying another Polish citizen on behalf of an occupier, that argument found no traction whatsoever. And a more extreme example, obviously, is the Lithuanian Museum of Genocide, where the genocide that's concerned, or the nominal genocide, has to do with ethnic Lithuanians, which I think would be acceptable, or at least, you know, discussable, were it not for the fact that another genocide involving Lithuanian citizens, namely the Jews, is not there. And you can say, you can take the view, well, that's a different event, but you can't take the view that it's a different event if you're thinking in terms of citizens, because after all, those people concerned were Lithuanian citizens. But again, the discussion is in terms of Lithuanians and Jews and Lithuanians, and not the citizens of Lithuania as it was in 1920, say, or 1939. So I think the result of all of this is that in terms of commemoration, we are thrown back towards not only national commemoration, but towards a kind of commemoration where causality is limited by artificially within national frameworks. We end up with a kind of commemorative causality, I think, where causality is enforcing commemoration, and commemoration is enforcing causality. What's interesting about this is that I think this is functioning both with the national histories and with the history of the Holocaust. So you have two solitudes, but in fact, I think they're the same solitude in some way. And this is the last big point that I want to make. I think that the opposition between the mainstream understanding of how the Holocaust happened and national or even nationalist separate narratives of the war, I think that opposition is in some way fundamentally comfortable for the people involved. And that for that reason, we can't expect it to be resolved by debate from the existing positions or to play itself out just as a result of European integration. I think we can expect it to continue on and on just as it's continued for the past 20 years. And again, I would stress that in some ways the position here is worse now than it was 20 years ago, or at least 5 years ago. What am I trying to argue? Okay, let me return to the two positions I discussed, and try to look at them a bit more abstractly. I think what you have is a kind of underlying agreement between civilizers and nationalizers. I think, what do I mean by civilizers? By civilizers, I mean the Western-oriented, institution-oriented, German-language-oriented view of the Holocaust. What does this have to do with civilization? Well, the main paradigm here is the breakdown of civilization. What went wrong in Germany, a civilized country, is the main question that's asked. Not why people died on a certain territory, but what went wrong in Germany. The other way that civilization is important for this point of view is that the Soviet Union is generally seen, and again, there are many exceptions, but in general, the Soviet Union, when it appears at all, is seen as an example of civilization. It has many flaws, but it is a civilization, and on the Eastern Front, it saves civilization, it liberates, and so forth. And the centrality of Auschwitz, in a way, plays into this, because Auschwitz is presented as the dark perversion of civilization in an Arendtian or in a Baumannian view. And Auschwitz is also the place where people think in terms of industrialized killing, somehow centralized or rational or so on, which is not any more true of Auschwitz than it is of the shooting pits in the East, but that's the image that we have. And then there's this very crucial idea, which we commemorate each 27th of January, which is the liberation of Auschwitz by the Soviets, where in some way the Soviets are restoring civilization to itself, which is a very powerful notion. And of course, there's a reason why it's so powerful. And that reason is that, of course, from the point of view of surviving Jews, in January 1945, the arrival of the Red Army was a liberation. Naturally it was. Of course it was. And we're right to remember it that way. However, that desperate perspective of January 1945, that desperate Jewish perspective of January 1945, does not quite embrace the whole history of how the Holocaust or other events of mass killing happened. If we look at all of this sharply and attentively, I think, and historically, we would have to remember other things. Like, for example, that the way that the city that the Germans call Auschwitz, which in Poland is Oświęcim, the reason why it fell into the Reich in the first place was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. That as a result of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, 2 million Jews who were not under German power fell under German power. That the Soviets in February 1940 refused, as of course they were bound to refuse, but they refused Eichmann's offer to send 2 million Jews to the Soviet Union. We have to take into account, when we think about the Soviets and the Germans, that the killing in Eastern Europe was worse, not where the Germans were alone, but where both the Germans and the Soviets were. And the places where the highest percentages of death took place were the places where there was a triple occupation, first Soviet, then German, and then Soviet. That, I think, disrupts a bit the liberation idea. But even if we look literally at the simple idea of the liberation of Auschwitz, it is sadly not as simple as that. The Red Army waited on the Vistula, less than 100 kilometers from Auschwitz, while the Łódź ghetto, again less than 100 kilometers away, was being emptied. 67,000 Jews who were alive went from Łódź when the Red Army reached the Vistula were dead by the time the Red Army reached Auschwitz. They waited at the Vistula while the concentration camps were emptied, and the death marches proceeded, and a few hundred thousand more people, Jews and non-Jews, died. Now, the waiting on the Vistula is very important in terms of a Polish national perspective, right? Because what was happening while the Red Army was waiting on the Vistula? That the Warsaw Uprising was happening, and 100,000 Poles were being killed by the Germans. But it's also, I think, just as important from a Jewish perspective. If the Red Army hadn't waited on the Vistula and instead had actually liberated Łódź, instead of arriving there after the Jews were gone, or actually liberated Auschwitz, instead of arriving there after it had been effectively emptied, that would be a very different story, but it didn't. And that's a signal, I think, of something that we ought to keep in mind, which was the general Soviet indifference to what we now call the Holocaust. There was not a Soviet policy, any more than there was an American or a British policy, particularly to save Jews. So, of course, it mattered that the Red Army liberated Eastern Europe. From a Jewish point of view, it mattered extraordinarily. It meant the difference between life and death. But to raise that to the level of identifying the Soviets with a kind of civilization, I think, is a mistake. And I think it's at the very least you could say it's only part of the discussion. So in sum, what one gets from this Western civilizer perspective, I think, is a kind of sliding scale of emphasis, where the main victims are from the civilized West. They're not the Ostjuden, although, of course, Eastern Jews are the people who really die in the largest numbers in the Holocaust. Other German victims, like the Soviet prisoners of war, who I keep belaboring, those people are mentioned even less. And the victims of Soviet crimes are mentioned the least of all. And the Soviet Union doesn't appear very much in the account, or it appears only at the margin, or it appears as liberators. Now, one side effect that all this has is that it means that the collaboration of East Europeans in the Holocaust and in other German crimes takes on a very great importance. Because since the Soviet Union is civilization or it's absent, then the people who take part in the East, and of course there were very many such people, hundreds of thousands, in fact, those people take on a huge importance. But the question which isn't asked is, why do they collaborate? The assumption is a German assumption. That is, they collaborate because they're anti-Semites, which sometimes is true, but most of the time it's actually not true. And you can't explain collaboration without understanding the experiences of the people who became collaborators on this territory, which this narrative doesn't allow you to do, because it starts in Germany and then jumps to the East. So you have no idea why it is that people might be collaborating or not collaborating, for that matter. So those people become marginalized. They appear as heavies. They appear under these various categories that the Germans used. But we don't know who they are or what they've experienced. That strikes me as a very important omission. Okay, how does that meet what I'm going to call now the nationalizer perspective? That is the kind of East European national history perspective. What I should have said about the Western perspective that I didn't is that the number that's important for the Western perspective is not 14 million, it's 6 million. The number that's important from these various Eastern perspectives is also not 14 million. That is not all the Europeans who were murdered, but it's some national number, right? And that national number is usually inflated. It's very, very hard to bring numbers down. It's very easy for numbers to go up. And then it's very, very hard to bring them back down again. That's a general rule. So for example, the number of Jews killed in the Khmelnytsky uprising of 1648 it turns out to be between 16 and 20,000, probably. But for centuries, it's been remembered as hundreds of thousands, or at least tens of thousands. And it's now, I think, been brought down. I think the consensus among historians of Jewish life in the 17th century is that it's much closer to 20,000. That took 350 years, I mean, to overcome, you know, Natan of Hanover's abyss of despair and bring the number down. It's very hard, what I'm trying to say is it's very hard to bring numbers down. There's very rarely an incentive to do so because people take offense. They say you're minimizing, you're doing something that you ought not to be doing. So you still very regularly hear, and I don't mean necessarily even in the East, but also in the West, the idea that 3 million non-Jewish Poles were killed. Probably there are people in this room who think that, who are raised to think that. The number of non-Jewish Poles killed in Poland was huge. It was horrifying, but it was probably on the range of 1 million. If you count people in concentration camps and forced laborers and so on, you can move towards 2 million, but certainly not higher than that. The Ukrainian state for some time was making a campaign to the effect that 10 million people died in the famine. Again, the last thing I would want to do would be to minimize the horror of the famine. However, I don't think that adding those extra 6.5 million people to the total in any way commemorates the event. The true number was somewhere between 2.5 and 4 million in all likelihood. But again, it's very hard to push these numbers down. But my larger point here is that the number that functions in national historiographies and in national discussions is not the total number of Europeans. It's some national number, usually inflated. And the rule of thumb, by the way, is that numbers are inflated by a factor of 3. I think that's what people think they can get away with, factor of 3. So if in doubt, you know, that's the rule of thumb. The key concept from this point of view, and again, I'm trying to talk about it more abstractly, is not civilization, that's the Western perspective, but national sovereignty. And national and sovereignty, from this perspective, is crucial because it's the organizing principle of political life today. But it makes Soviet power much more important, because Soviet power was not only violent, as of course Nazi power was as well, but it continued into the lifetimes of many of the people concerned. It denied statehood or sovereignty for many decades after the Second World War. And from this perspective, it's very hard to see, at least for many people, Soviet power as an instance of civilization. It's very often seen as the opposite of civilization, or more particularly, it's seen as an instance of the destruction of civilization, because in many cases, Baltic cases, Ukrainian cases, Polish cases, Belarusian cases for that matter, it was precisely the educated elites who were the first targets of Soviet killing campaigns. And given that that's true, Soviet policy often looks much more like de-enlightenment than it looks like some version of enlightenment. From the nationalizer perspective, it's not so much that the Holocaust is ignored or minimized. Everyone knows, the interesting thing about Eastern Europe is that everyone has some sense of the Holocaust because, of course, that's where it happened. That's where the death pits were. And locally, from town to town, village to village, you can find things out this way just by talking to people, because it's preserved in memory, in some very narrow understanding of memory. However, the national paradigm can't embrace the Holocaust precisely because the Holocaust crosses national boundaries, but also because, as I said before, the nation is so often seen in ethnic terms that it's very easy to talk about Poles and Jews or Lithuanians and Jews and so on, as though that were normal, as though that actually exhausted the reality. But the other problem, and here I'm coming to my argument, the other problem is that there is very little, if anything, in the sophisticated Western accounts of the Holocaust which could overturn this view. There are reasons why the Western literature simply can't make sense of this. And those reasons are the reasons that I discussed, that the terrains of Eastern Europe are not real in Western Europe. In West European accounts of the Holocaust, American accounts of the Holocaust, and again, there are laudable exceptions, like Yehuda Bauer's recent excellent study of the end of the shtetl is a good one. But in general, Western studies of the Holocaust are histories of Poland and Ukraine and Belarus and so on, which Poles and Ukrainians and Belarusians have a hard time recognizing because the place names are all misspelled, or there's no knowledge of topography. Everything comes out unreal. The numbers of people in the different national categories are wrong. They're just basic things which reveal that the study does not take seriously these territories. And of course, there are other reasons why it doesn't make sense of it as well, but this is part of the problem, that even as we continue to work on the Holocaust and we move it to the East, we're not reaching East Europeans. But I think, and I'm afraid this is a very pessimistic conclusion, as I've already suggested, but I think that the problem is in some way deeper than that, that what seems to be an opposition between the civilization position and the nation position is a very, very comfortable sort of controversy. It's very comfortable. These positions that stake out oppositions in memory wars are putting stakes down in places that are familiar to them, and they can keep doing this for a very long time. Intragenerationally, it's turning out. I mean, the idea that because there's a new generation, everything's going to be different is, of course, obviously nonsense. I think these two positions are very comfortable where they are, and I think there are four points of commonality, which means that unless some kind of action is taken by Rory, in particular, that they're very likely to be with us for a long time. One of these, so let me spell out these four ways. One of them is what you might think of as Holocaust isolationism. So from a Western position, it's generally taken for granted that the Holocaust is unique, or I would prefer the word unprecedented. That's very much the case. It is unprecedented. There is no crime like it. However, if you cannot research the other cases and bring them into your account of the Holocaust, the claim, which many in the West take for granted that the Holocaust is unique or unprecedented, is very hard to defend. It's very hard to persuade people, especially people who know a great deal about other killing campaigns of which you might never even have heard, that the Holocaust was unprecedented, as I prefer to say. So without considering other cases of mass killing, German or for that matter Soviet, that happened where the Holocaust happened, sometimes simultaneously, sometimes with the same perpetrators, the image of the Holocaust as a unique crime doesn't come through. The idea that it's unique becomes hortatory. It becomes moralizing, and people find it easy to reject. So the problem isn't just that people don't compare. It's that they're not in a position in the paradigm that I described earlier to compare, even if they wanted to compare. But it's even worse than that, because it's not just that we're not comparing, it's that in the Holocaust narrative, we're leaving out certain things that might be very important to the Holocaust narrative just because they're beyond the geographical or temporal framework that we've accepted. So we just don't mention that that the Germans planned to use and indeed did use elements of the Soviet system, like the collective farm, the central institution of the Soviet system, in my view. We don't mention that German war planning for the demodernization of the Soviet Union was explicitly designed to reverse certain Soviet policies. We certainly don't mention that in 1937 and 1938, Stalin embarked on a policy of mass ethnic shootings, which far, far exceeded anything that the Germans would do before the war. This simply doesn't appear. And the idea, which I think is really worth considering, that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, that is the alliance between Germany and the Soviet Union, is a causal element in the Holocaust, at least as it happened. That's generally not considered either. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact just comes in. It's taken for granted. But it's a very important event, if you think about it. It's what allows Germany to have a very large population of Jews. And everything that follows, in some sense, follows from that. And remember, there was an alternative. The Germans, for 5 years, were trying to get Poland to invade the Soviet Union with them. Now, if Germany and Poland had invaded the Soviet Union together, I'm sure that would not have been good for the Jews, right? That there would have been some version of a final solution. However, I think we can say with confidence that it would have been different, because we know that when Germany collaborated with sovereign states, even when they were weaker sovereign states, like Bulgaria or Hungary or Romania, policies towards the Jews were hostile, but they were also constrained by state sovereignty, which is not the case with the Poland, which is destroyed. And how is Poland destroyed? It's destroyed by the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. I think that's something which is at least worth considering, and it doesn't even function. And I mention it in particular because the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is a big part of the historical imaginary of Poles and Balts and Ukrainians in different ways. And the fact that it doesn't even figure in, for the most part, in the historiography of the Holocaust makes that historiography a little bit alienating. Okay. But there's, again, I'm afraid, a deeper problem, and that is that some of the features of the Holocaust narrative as I've described it are all too familiar in Eastern Europe, all too familiar in a way which is unattractive, or perhaps too attractive. The idea of uniqueness, for example, very familiar in Eastern Europe. The emphasis on perpetrators and victims, very familiar in Eastern Europe. The idea that certain sources have privileged status over others, which I think is a mistake, but that's an idea which some students of the Holocaust have proposed. That's very familiar. The reason why all of these things are familiar is that this is what East European historiography has been doing for the last 200 years. That is how national historiography is built up. The idea that there is something unique, that there are insiders and outsiders, that you use some sources and you ignore others, that you use some languages and not others, and that there's a moral lesson to it all. That is the internal structure of East European national history as it's been constructed since Palatsky, Khrushchevsky, you name it, and it's true to this day. Now, let me be clear about what I'm not saying. I am not saying that the Holocaust is, in fact, national history. Nor am I saying that the people who write about it from this, what I've called the civilizer point of view, want it to be national history. I think the Holocaust has not only a significance, but also causal connections which go far beyond any nation, be it Jewish or German. And I think it's the simple inherent structure of it, that it was an attempt to exterminate an entire people, makes it special in a way which no national history can embrace. That said, I think the default outcome, an unintended outcome, of the way that Holocaust history is structured in the West is that in Eastern Europe it feels familiar. It feels like one more national history. And that means that it becomes a kind of competitor, because that's what national histories do, one with the other. They compete. They compete over territory, they compete over numbers, they compete over who in fact was the victim and who in fact was the perpetrator, which is in fact what we see. So I hope it's clear what I'm trying to say. I'm not just saying that the reach of the excellent and sophisticated history of the Holocaust is limited because of sources and geography and things like that. I'm saying that insofar as it does reach Eastern Europe, it is often received as one more national history among others, and that that leads to a kind of comfortable competition. The second reason why I think we're stuck, for a while at least, is what you might think of as the linguistic truce between the civilizer position and the nationalizer position, which goes like this. We agree not to learn your languages if you agree not to learn ours. What has happened in Eastern Europe is that, to a surprising extent, East European historians have learned English, right? I mean, that's not surprising, but they've learned English and then stopped. So the problem of Czech and Polish and Ukrainian and so on historians who don't know German is becoming very, very serious indeed. And you can even start to speak of a problem of Polish historians not knowing Russian, which indeed, given the way that the whole historical, the Polish national memory is constructed, you'd think that would be a problem, but it doesn't seem to be in practice. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, think for a minute and try to come up with someone who was an established historian of Germany who learned an East European language after 1989. If you have an example, you know, write it on a piece of paper and pass it up to the front. Because I think it simply didn't happen. And that's in a way striking because, of course, the Holocaust, not to belabor the point, happened in Eastern Europe. And all or most of the new source material that we have about the Holocaust comes in Yiddish or Polish or Ukrainian or Russian or other East European languages, which are now bountifully accessible, but you have to know the language. So I think that's worth thinking. Eastern Europe is becoming less polyglot, and Western Europe has not become noticeably more polyglot at the same time. And so there's this kind of truce. And this truce means that strange misunderstandings continue. So for example, think about June and July of 1941. These are the crucial weeks, I would argue, of the Second World War in many ways. This is the time of Operation Barbarossa, when then you have immediate local collaboration in the killing of Jews that then comes to be called later on the Holocaust. These are very important moments. And yet, what actually happened in the summer of 1941 with those pogroms? How many studies do we have which use both the local language and German? 20 years on, the answer is very, very few. On the Polish case, we have Jan Gross and Andrzej Zbikowski, who are not using German sources. In Ukrainian, we have Marko Carenik and Jean-Paul Hemke, who are using German sources but haven't published yet. In the Lithuanian case, we have two Germans, Joachim Tauber and Christoph Diekmann, who are using some Lithuanian sources but, again, haven't published yet. So it's been two decades. And it would seem that this very crucial thing, exactly what happened at this juncture where the Germans come in and locals start killing Jews, that we might have made more progress on that than we actually have. I'm startled by how little progress we've made. I think we will solve it. Another example, though, of this kind of linguistic truce or its consequences is the permanently controversial question of how many Jews there were in the upper reaches of the Soviet NKVD. Now, this is a question which is answerable, because there are statistical manuals in Russian which answer it. Why is it so controversial? The reason it's so controversial is that the people who write about these questions in connection with the Holocaust are usually relying upon some kind of secondary source, which has, not surprisingly, some kind of interest in the question one way or another, since it is perhaps the most controversial question of all. But the reason why it's not addressed, as I try to address in the book in a straightforward way in terms of the numbers, is that people can't read Russian statistical manuals, even when they should be concerned with these issues. And this means that, again, 20 years on, this question, which is, I think, thoroughly resolvable. I mean, you could just put, if I use slides, I could put one up. And show you how many Jews there were in the Ukrainian Enkvede, in Kharkiv or Kiev, and then in Moscow. These things are known, and the story is not as interesting as anybody would want it to be. I mean, I can tell it if you would like, but the point is that this is a controversy which need not be happening at this point, and it's happening over and over and over again, partly because I think this problem of linguistic taboos or linguistic ignorance. And a third question, which leads to endless polemic, which I also think is resolvable, is whether Stalin or Hitler killed more people. We have a very firm in the West answer to this, which is that Stalin killed more people, but Hitler was nevertheless worse because of the Holocaust. I think that's the standard view. The problem with that is that the Soviet documentation that we have of the terror and our best estimates of the famine and the documentation that we have of deaths in the Gulag do not actually support that conclusion. The Soviet documentation that we now have suggests that, in fact, the Germans killed more people than the Soviets. And specialists know that, and yet it's going to be, I think, years before that sinks through. And why does it not sink through? Because our power of repetition about this is so much stronger than the documents are, because they're in the wrong language. Okay. The third reason why these two positions, I think, are in a kind of comfortable controversy is what I would think of as terminological quicksand. The term that I have in mind is genocide, which I think is the creation of which is one of the heroic acts of intellectual history of the 20th century, and the prosecution for which is one of the most interesting things happening in legal culture today. However, in historical terms or in memory terms, the term genocide has been hugely, hugely problematic. Let me try to put this in a striking way. There's a dispute now among Europeans, East Europeans, as to whether there was one genocide or two. There's a so-called double genocide thesis, according to which what the Soviets did was also a genocide. And this is hugely controversial to those who want to say that there's only one genocide, namely the Holocaust of the Jews. None of this makes any sense. If we take the definition of the word genocide seriously, there were multiple genocides on both sides, multiple on the German side and multiple on the Soviet side. If we pay attention to the definition as it is in the UN Convention of 1948, there were several Soviet and several German genocides. So the idea that the correct answer is one or two doesn't actually make sense. But the reason why this controversy can, and I fear will go on forever, is that there's a popular understanding of the word genocide, according to which genocide means the attempt to physically exterminate an entire people. And under that definition, there is only one genocide, and that is the Holocaust. But then the question arises, if there is only one genocide and it's the Holocaust, what's the additional added value of using the word genocide? Because logically speaking, there's none. And I think the reason why it's used is that there is a certain lack of confidence about the history of the Holocaust by the people who practice it. They're not sure about these comparisons. They're less sure about them, I think, than they ought to be. And the reason they're less sure than they ought to be is because they're not investigating the other relevant cases. And so we pile on terms, where in fact the historical truth of the unprecedented character of the Holocaust is actually quite clear. But it becomes clearer, not less clear, when you add the other cases in. But if you're not in a position to do that, then you feel defensive, and things like terms and numbers start to matter perhaps a little bit more than they should. The fourth way in which these two positions are in a kind of comfortable controversy is that they have common enemies, interestingly enough. If you partition up the history of mass killing or of Eastern Europe, you take one stage and you put national history here, Soviet policy here, Nazi policy here. In a sense, that's comfortable. When people try to break down those walls or any of those walls, they take huge criticism, interestingly, from both sides, right? If you try to put the Holocaust into a larger history, you will be criticized by nationalizers, and you will also be criticized by civilizers. And what both of them will say is that you are an ally of the other. You're undermining the Holocaust narrative, thereby you're helping East European nationalists. And the extreme East European nationalists will say, you're making the Holocaust narrative too important at the expense of our national suffering, and your position is essentially a Jewish nationalist one. So these two sides, although they wouldn't go to cocktail parties together for the most part, are in intellectual terms, objectively, as people used to say, very often allies. And what they're allies against, oddly enough, is an attempt, I think, to get the history, to make the history more comprehensive than it actually is. Why are they comfortable together? This is the last point that I'm going to make. I think the reason why the two reasons why they're comfortable together is that they share what I called in the beginning the post-colonial epistemic, by which I don't mean some kind of sophisticated analysis of what post-colonialism really is. By the post-colonial epistemic, I mean seeing like a state plus feeling like a victim. Those two things together, and I think both the civilizers and the nationalizers have that. From the civilizer point of view. It's we see like the state, and of course we're very sorry, or we're very critical. From the nationalizer point of view, it's that we see from the point of view of the German and Soviet states, and there is more to be sorry for than anyone really recognizes. There are more crimes, they have to be added on. But in both cases, you're seen like a state and you're feeling like a victim. And the commemorative arrangement that follows from all this is a very interesting one. I mean, to simplify it somewhat, the arrangement is like this. You in the West commemorate the Holocaust where it didn't happen, and we in the East will commemorate Stalinist crimes that didn't actually affect us, like the famine and the terror. That is basically the deal, a kind of temporal geographic arrangement. I'm exaggerating somewhat, but that's basically the way it works, where East European suffering under communism includes things that actually happened further to the East. I'm thinking of the Poles and in the post-war satellites in particular, whereas the commemoration of the Holocaust happens largely in places where not, relatively speaking, not very many Jews actually die. But I think the underlying reason why this post-colonial epistemic is so comfortable is that the ethical corollary of it is comfortable, namely that it's okay to identify with the victims. And again, I wrote a whole book about why it's important to see the victims as individuals, not as numbers. But nevertheless, I think there are problems with jumping too quickly to the victim position. I think that this means that you have an awful lot of freedom in interpretation that maybe you shouldn't have. I think it means from the civilizer position that you have difficulty understanding the motives of the perpetrators and the bystanders, although again, there are many important exceptions to this, like Christopher Browning, for example. I think from the nationalizer point of view, it means that you're too often identifying on a whole national scale people as being victims of the Soviets rather than participants. I think of the law in Poland, for example, which forbids you from saying, or writing rather, that a Polish citizen took part in National Socialism or Communism, which, you know, that would put all of us historians in jail, basically. And in fact, I had a Polish historian friend who was trying to reserve a particular cell for the two of us ahead of time. So it's a problem in that way as well. And in the harshest versions, in the sort of extreme versions, it means that on the civilizer side, the perpetrators and the collaborators are not human in the sense that there's no attempt to understand them because they're evil or they're beyond morality. And on the nationalizer version, at the extreme, you come up with excuses for the perpetrators and the collaborators because they were victims, and if you're a victim, therefore you have an excuse. But in both cases, you end up, I think, with a certain surplus of moralization over explanation. And this in turn leads to educational programs, both Holocaust education and national education, which go along parallel lines, I think, without touching each other nearly as much as they ought to. I think that these pedagogical lines are followed by commemorative lines, and that the commemorative lines end up then going back and influencing the causal explanation so that we continue to have these parallel histories, these parallel, if you like, tunnels under the ground, which are all individually very dark, but which don't meet each other perhaps where they should. And we have commemoration which involves only ideology and victims. Now that might seem like, why should it be any other way? Why would we commemorate any other thing? And I'm gonna try to give you a quick answer. In the beginning of the 21st century, putting ideological questions completely aside for a moment, we are heading into a world political economy which is not so different from the world political economy of the 1920s, namely the resource which was at the center of both Stalinist and German thinking, again, leaving the cultural part of ideology aside, namely food, is once again going to become short. There are once again going to be resource crises having to do with food and other fundamental resources. We have now worked ourselves into a position where all we think about when we commemorate or even write historically about these events is the cultural side of ideology, generally leaving out, and again, there are many exceptions to this, of course, among historians, but generally leaving out the political economic part, which means that we are not prepared for what's about to hit us, even though we have a very powerful example in the 20th century of what can happen when people start thinking ambitiously about what groups to exclude from resources and what groups to privilege in terms of resources, whether that's by race or whether that's by class. That connection is, for all practical purposes, never made. No one says, we can learn from the Holocaust something about how to deal with food shortages or how desperately important they are. No one says we can learn from collectivization about the importance of food as a resource. It's simply not done. So the memory lesson, in effect, excludes the historical lesson, although let me note what I'm not trying to say. I'm not trying to say that we ought not to remember the hatred or the cultural side of the ideology. We ought to. But what's happened is that because of what I'm calling commemorative causality, we're forgetting some of the causes of these events. And because we forget some of the causes, we're forgetting some of the things that are really under our control a little bit. Ideology of other nations is a bit hard to control, but resources are something which one, over which one can, from the position of the European Union or the US, actually do something. Okay, I'll close that bracket. How would we solve all of this? And again, like, this is the point where I should yield the floor to Rory and his colleagues, but I would just like to make a couple of quick arguments about how some of this might be addressed in terms of more history rather than less history. Let me begin from a simple observation. We cannot expect that EU enlargement will solve this. I mean, this maybe is already obvious. I think EU enlargement, if anything, has created the false expectation that out of the many national histories there can become one, just as out of many national markets there can become one. And of course, that's simply not the case. And the fact of enlargement has simultaneously made Hungarian, Polish, Czech national narratives easier to carry out, and it's made Ukrainian and Belarusian national narratives, I think, probably more defensive at the same time. So what could we do about this, which isn't just EU enlargement? Well, one thing which is very simple, and probably I'm sure many people have thought of this before me, is that we could have a norm of Holocaust education. And there are many places that carry out Holocaust education, right? From Berkeley to Yale, from Yad Vashem, you know, to the German Historical Institute. There are many, many places that do this. What if there were an international norm that people who do it have to learn two languages, German plus some other language, or maybe even three, German plus a Jewish language, plus an East European language? And what if the way that were done is that exchanges were organized among the places that do Holocaust education in these various places, so that you could learn Hebrew and that would be subsidized, or you could learn Polish and that would be subsidized, or German if that were what you needed? This seems like a very simple thing, and I think it could be easily handled, but it is a problem. It's a growing problem. At Yad Vashem, they're concerned now about the lack of Polish, because the generation which somehow knew Polish from home or from parents is passing, and the number of people who are learning Polish in Israel is very small, and unfortunately growing smaller. In Poland, as I mentioned, there's a serious problem with German. And you just can't get very far in the history of the Holocaust or the occupation of Poland without the German language, although people try bravely. So this is one thing. I think this kind of, if that norm became general, we would have admittedly slightly fewer books about the Holocaust than we have. But I think we could probably manage that. I think it would be better to have slightly fewer books which were more informed by language than to have the flood that we do have now. The second thing that I would propose, and this is related, is to think of the European Union as a kind of European Union of the mind. So there are various theories, as the political scientists here will know better than me, of why EU integration works. And one of them is called intergovernmentalism. That is, you have cooperation among relative ministries, and that's what moves the whole thing forward. What if there were intergovernmentalism at the level of the memory ministries? That is, what if the European Union said to all the memory ministries, the Polish, the Czech, the Ukrainian, the Hungarian, and let's include, just for argument's sake, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, the Ukrainian one, which is beyond the EU, Yad Vashem, and say this: everyone who has a permanent position at one of these memory ministries will be subsidized to take a stage, a year abroad, at any of the other memory ministries, and we will cover that. That would mean that this would mean circulation and cross-fertilization, as well as linguistic learning. And I think it would make the national paradigms which these memory ministries now foster willy-nilly much harder to sustain. And it wouldn't cost very much. It'd be relatively easy, and I think it would do an awful lot of good. The final point that I'll make is a more intellectual one. But let me again stay with this EU analogy. It's now an analogy. One of the things that we know the EU does is that it gets rid of protectionism. But what strikes me in these discussions is that the preponderance or the domination, certainly the continuation of something that you might think of as a protectionism of the mind. We have learned the lessons of the 1930s in terms of trade barriers, but it is striking to me how much the discussion about the Holocaust and Soviet crimes is still shaped by the 1930s. It's still shaped by the Popular Front. It's still shaped by the categories and loyalties which have so much to do with not just the war, which I've been dwelling on, but also the pre-war period of ideological polarization, the sense that you have to be loyal to one or the other, and that everybody is, in some sense, despite what they say, aligned with one or the other in some way. I think that there's a need to get over that, just as there was a need to get over the other kinds of protectionism of the 1930s. And I think the central issue of this is that we have to get over the comparability taboo. What do I mean by that? I don't mean that I've just written a big book about how we should compare. That's, by the way, not what the book is about. There are only a few paragraphs about comparison, and they're at the very end, so you either have to cheat or read the whole book through. But what I am saying is that the comparability taboo, the idea that for whatever reason, if you're writing about the Holocaust, you're only writing about the Holocaust. Or in some quarters, if you're writing about Soviet crimes, you're only writing about Soviet crimes. That this comparability taboo is unsustainable, and the attempt to sustain it has been intellectually and politically, I think, incredibly damaging. The reason why it's unsustainable is that it is simply unenforceable in daily life. It can be enforced, you know, in some arrondissement of Paris, and it can be enforced in some university departments in the United States, but it cannot be enforced in Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, it's not even an issue. I mean, if you tell people that there's some kind of taboo about comparing these things in general, they'll just shrug their shoulders and say, you know, well, I think this or I think that. But the taboo is unsustainable. And if you think about it, there's a reason for that. And that reason is historical. And that is everyone, going back to the 30s and 40s, everyone who lived in the zone where the Germans killed, or if you like, in the zone where the Holocaust took place, everybody, if they survived, also experienced Soviet power. Because the place where the Germans killed was covered by Soviet power, if not in 1939, then in 1945. Which means that everyone, in one way or another, had some kind of occasion to compare. And one can mention dramatic examples. So for example, starving Ukrainian peasants in Soviet Ukraine of 1933, who lived only to be starved again in German prisoner of war camps in 1941. Or you can think of Jews in 1939, who, when the Soviets and the Germans are both invading, are trying to decide which way to go. Or you can think of Poles in the summer of 1944, trying to decide whether it would be better to resist the Germans in Warsaw or wait for the Soviets to arrive without doing anything. Those are dramatic examples of people having to compare. But in every respect, the people, the 100 million or so people who lived in this zone at the time, had to compare. It was effectively banal. It was a quotidian experience to compare. They were condemned to compare. So for that reason, it's not surprising that comparability is taken for granted in much of the world. But also, it's not surprising that when we try to remove comparability from our own histories, whether that's from a national point of view or from a point of view concerned with the Holocaust, that we're denuding historical life of one of its central elements. So I think that for that reason alone, we ought to be questioning any sort of taboo on comparison, not because the two systems were equal or the same, I very much think they were rather different, but because you cannot see the differences unless you allow for the comparison. And this is going to really be my final point. I think if you drop the protectionism, the intellectual protectionism, and you write about the Holocaust in light of other events, and you let the dynamic of taboo provocation, taboo provocation, taboo provocation just fade, if you just let that go, then what will happen is that each of these events will take on its own shape in light of the others. And of course, the relations between one and the others are different. The relationship between the famine in Soviet Ukraine and the German starvation policies of 1941 is there. And that's different between the relationship between, say, Soviet and Nazi terror in Poland, which exists. I'd have to give a whole other talk to explain what it is. But the bottom line is this. If you allow these things to drift into contact with each other and take them all seriously, then you are, in fact, in a position to say defensively, and I think persuasively, across all of Europe, and not just in your own department or your own country, what is special and what is not. And with particular respect to the Holocaust, I think if you allow it to become European history and write about it where it took place, that is when, in historical but also in political and memory terms, its special and unprecedented character actually will become clear. Thank you.
This podcast is part of a larger public program of seminars, exhibitions, and festivals produced by Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, an initiative from the Department of Slavonic Studies at the University of Cambridge. Find out more of what we do at www.cambridgeukrainianstudies.org or find us on Facebook. Music provided by our friends, the Ukrainians.